The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, a few weeks ago, we talked about wars being fought just a little bit differently, both militarily, but also currency wars, you know, where you have people who are actually competing to devalue their currency to gain business from other countries that may have stronger currencies.
So on the one hand, it's no surprise that we're seeing the topic in the Wall Street Journal this week, but it is important who is commenting on it.
Yeah, it's the Bank of England, I think, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. Governor Murphy King, and this is from John Hilsenrath's article earlier this week, has warned of the risk of currency wars in the coming year as nations search for new ways to spur their economies in a world of slow growth and few other options. Reading here from the Wall Street Journal, as they report, a cheap currency, in theory, makes exports more competitive and thus helps to spur economic output. And this was the speech that Governor Mervyn King was giving at the Economic Club of New York and then an interview with the Wall Street Journal. And he basically said, I do think 2013 could be a challenging year in which we will in fact see a number of countries trying to push down their exchange rates. That does lead to concerns. Will other countries react in kind? What will happen? Mr. King said in the interview, the policies pursued by countries for domestic purposes are leading to tension collectively.
Well, and David, I think we should point out, this is actually being considered a policy tool. These are active decisions to push a currency down. And, you know, the thing that's just so sad about that is, for the person who saves money, actually has that particular currency, it just destroys the buying power of that currency. Now, granted, it may make that country more competitive. It might even add to the employment of that country. But it kills the saver, doesn't it?
It goes back to one of the things that we've talked about many times. You can't just simply look at economics and some sort of an economic calculus. You have to look at things from an interdisciplinary standpoint to really understand what's happening today.
Right.
This is a domestic fiscal policy which has international political consequences. And that's why this is a really big deal. It really is a big deal because you're not talking about a war with tanks and bombs and guns. You're talking about weapons that are financial and economic in nature, but they still have a political and geopolitical calculus.
Well, and they seem to have even more of a widespread outcome than, you know, military war. Let's face it, Dave, here on our own shores, the Federal Open Market Committee, the Federal Reserve, they're doing the same type of thing, aren't they?
You know, they meet this week and they're expected to extend Operation Twist with a few changes necessary as they're actually running out of the short-dated paper, which they've been using to swap for the long-dated treasuries and thus suppress or drag down the long-term treasury yield.
Well, let's stop there for a second. Okay, they're running out of short-dated paper. I mean, isn't there enough paper out there to satisfy the Fed's need?
Well, you know, Operation Twist was different than other quantitative easing measures because it was considered quote-unquote balance sheet neutral. In other words, they were just swapping one piece of paper for another, and they weren't seeing growth in the balance sheet in question. Now, coming into 2013, there is a certain expectation that they move not only to extend Twist in some degree, where, again, that's the balance sheet neutral part,
right,
but there's more and more discussion that they may expand their balance sheet to $4 trillion from the current $3 trillion.
How is that neutral?
Well, that's not neutral at all, and I think that's where we're moving into dangerous territory. If you look at the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, not the New York Fed, because their leverage is off the charts,
right,
but if you look at the collective banks, member banks of the Federal Reserve System, they're currently leveraged at over 50-1. 50-1. And what they're talking about doing, and if they do move to $4 trillion, you're talking about a 66-1 leverage.
Well, even at 50-1, Dave, I mean, that means you've got $2 down for every 100 that you're talking about risking.
And that's right, because it only is 2% volatility, where the portfolio of assets they hold drops by that amount, 2%, and it wipes out their capital base.
Right.
We ultimately see the balance sheet expanding to $5 trillion. And that's, I think, before our international creditors figure out that an exit strategy, and I put that in quotes because that's what they've always put in quotes, the Fed believes they can still exit from this kind of an asset purchase program. And that exit strategy, we think, is going to be impossible.
Yeah.
As they attempt to do that, we think our foreign creditors are going to get out in front of the Fed in terms of liquidations. Before the Treasury market begins to implode and interest rates increase, you're going to see market activity that is way out in front of the Fed exit strategy.
Well, and, you know, we've talked before, David, that you can have a creeping inflation. You can have inflation that even gets to be relatively high. But there is a moment when people no longer want to hold the currency that looks like it can't be supported anymore. And, you know, we don't know when that moment will come. It's probably hard to understand the trigger point, but it's out there.
What you're really talking about is a cusp event where you'd have a certain degree of pressure that exists in the system already. And what is the precipitating event? I mean, we live here in Colorado. We have no snow, so this is maybe a bad example at present, but we're really hoping yeah, that by the end of
but
December,
I know where you're going, because you've been near or almost on an avalanche in the past. And
well,
you
sure
understand there are signs, but you don't know exactly when it's going to let go.
Is it a snowflake? Is it a bird fluttering by? Is it a climber? Is it a snowmobile? There's a number of things that can cause the natural state of instability to trigger and become an uncontrolled event. And that's, I think, what people are not assuming. In economic departments, don't assume it because they can't figure it out.
Right.
It is a sociological, not an economic. It is a psychological, not an economic event. And their models only deal with economics. And it's very interesting because over the last few years, the frustration of economists has led to a brand new field in as sort of a subset to economics, and it, what you call behavioral finance.
It's like psychology.
It really is. But to look at the financial decision-making process that people go through, it's not mathematical calculus. It can't be summed up with an equation. And that's, I think, the frustrating thing is when you look at 2015 to 2016, and you know, what I just suggested in terms of our international creditors and current holders of treasuries who are very happy holding those treasuries because they're very liquid, when they try to get in front of the Fed and the Fed's exit strategy, you're likely to see something that is a market event which doesn't fit any economic calculus. It is a little bit like a bank run. What caused it? And then what were the subsequent events which reinforced it and made it a fait accompli?
Well, you know, Dave, I think we should probably look. We were talking about economics and the equations, but actually there's an equation that's been used since the 1930s from John Maynard Keynes that talks about decreasing unemployment, or in other words, employing more people, by increasing consumption. And the printing of this money, these currency wars and printing money and trying to be more competitive, all of that really is a way of trying to keep people fully employed. So, I mean, let's look at employment in America right now. It's barely holding on, even with all the printing.
But you are talking about the FOMC's calculus being related to a certain set of assumptions or presuppositions which are inherently Keynesian. In other words, we're going to fix the employment issue by stimulating consumption, and we're going to stimulate consumption by creating enough credit and liquidity to do so.
Right.
It's an inherently Keynesian problem, and there's a number of weaknesses that get built in, systemic weaknesses that get built into the system on that basis. And the Keynesians love the clean math of it, even more than, I mean, if you go through John Maynard Keynes, you won't see a single math problem or equation in his book. It's basically the neo-Keynesians, which have taken his ideas and tried to turn them into a pseudoscience.
Right.
And now they've got the math problems to prove that Keynes was right. Well, if your assumptions are right, perhaps, but if your assumptions are wrong, that's where you end up with a tremendous amount of travail.
Okay, well, speaking of assumptions, granted, they're printing money, and they're saying, yes, we're starting to add jobs. But, I mean, a lot of those jobs, Dave, that's not the whole story, is it?
Well, in the last 5 months, 73% of the new jobs created were in government.
They don't produce anything.
Now, think about this.
Yeah.
Coming into the election, you've got a major push in terms of jobs and employment.
But three quarters of the new jobs that were added in the last 5 months don't produce anything.
You're talking about 600,000 votes. I mean, jobs coming into the election. Talk about election gaming par excellence. I mean, when you look and stand back and say, wait a minute, what is really going on here? You realize that Jack Welch was right. Jack Welch was right. They absolutely were playing games with the employment numbers in September and October coming into the election. And guess what? The BLS just restated and lowered the employment numbers for September and October. They had to revise them lower because they had been playing games in those 2 months leading up to the election. Oh, Jack, let's print an apology. No, you're not going to see that from the news media. They castigated him, made him seem like a fool. How can you question the Bureau of Labor Statistics? These guys are good with their math. They're good with their numbers. Is anyone paying attention after the fact? You should be.
Well, and I'll tell you, Dave, if employment was really as good as it looks, I mean, let's say that it wasn't just government jobs, you wouldn't have 47 million people on food stamps right now. I mean, remember growing up? food stamps, that was something that a very rare, what was it, 2 or 3% of the people that were out there back in the 70s actually were on food stamps.
In the 1970s, it was one out of every 50 Americans that was on food stamps.
Okay.
One out of 50. Now, the most recent increase was 607,559 people were newly enrolled in food stamps. That brings us to 47.7 million participants, and that is one in 6.5 people in America. So, used to be, and again, the 1970s had their fair share of a rough patch.
Sure.
We had a pretty nasty recession for several years in the 70s. Inflation was an issue, but there was one in 50 Americans on food stamps today. Today, it's one in 6.5. That is astounding. Since 2001, spending on this particular program has quadrupled. And it's doubled just in the last 4 years.
So it's just everything spiking at the same time that we're hearing this fiscal cliff discussion that's going on.
Well, this week, yeah, we remain on the ping pong table, if you will, the fiscal cliff ping pong table. You've got the GOP and you've got the Democrats. They lob the ball back and forth, hoping that they won't be the ones who are blamed for the outcome, whatever the outcome is. Now, what is the fiscal cliff? I mean, in brief, lawmakers recognized a number of months ago their inability to negotiate a budget deal, and that had gone on for over 18 months. So they chose to pressure themselves going into the new administration with indiscriminate budget cuts at year end. It was just, we'll get it solved if we know that there's the sword of Damocles hanging over our head. And lo and behold, they're having a tough time doing it.
Well, you know what it reminds me of when you're a kid, somebody says, you know, well, stick a needle in my eye if I don't do it. Well, the needle's just about to go into the eye. And, you know, it's inconvenient, though. Here we are at Christmas time. Don't the guys who are negotiating this have families at home that they want to get back to?
Well, several points are worthy of note. Number one is the time frame chosen was instantly awkward because neither party wanted to work on the issue prior to the election. Mm-hmm. Playing cards which could, in fact, jeopardize various political races, including the one for the White House. So even though year-end sounded like a good idea originally, this year being an election year meant that the budget overhaul was untouchable until the mid-November period, leaving just 6 weeks for wrangling, which they had hitherto found unresolvable for a multi-year time frame. It's astounding. Number two, you've got the motivation to do something. It is there now. The nature of the cuts, again, going back to that word indiscriminate, it means that a lot of pet projects are going to get nicked and that the political blowback from constituents in the midterm could be very unsettling for a lot of politicians. So something is likely to be announced, though we would suggest that it's only enough to avoid sort of the automatic and arbitrary hatchet.
Well, you know, you had said something to me last night that really hit me. You said, you know, these cuts, they're just across the board. So let's say they are cutting 17%. Well, take that with the Navy, okay? That's cutting cleaning fluids for bathroom cleanup 17%. But it's also cutting ammunition, radar.
Fuel,
yeah. So this is one of those things like a piece of salami. You don't really choose exactly what part you're going to have. You just slice it.
Well, right, and that's what's awkward for these politicians is they, and that's what they created was the awkwardness around it's too painful to do and it's not very responsible to do. Therefore, we will get off our duff and do something. But guess what they were doing, actually?
And here we
playing
are.
Politics through the election, and they didn't leave themselves enough time to put something together that would actually be a long-term working solution looking at our issues. What are the core issues that we've had? We've been running a budget deficit of over $1 trillion a year for 4 years in a row. We've increased the national debt. This week, we will exceed the debt ceiling again.
So they have to come up with another decision. Are we going to be able to poke through that again?
Wednesday of this week, we'll already be through it, and there's no discussion on it.
Okay.
So the issue is we will borrow from the Social Security quote-unquote trust fund, not really a trust fund, just a slush fund, if you will, for any political purpose. It can be used. Did you realize that? Did you realize you can use Social Security funds for anything you want? Because using a unified budget, everything goes into one pot in terms of revenues, and you pull out of that same pot for any expenditure. It doesn't matter. The idea that we have a trust fund, it's a misnomer. It's a total misnomer. But I'm moving beyond the point.
Well, okay, but let me ask you a question. We're going to sit down and we're going to say, okay, our budget this year is this much. You know, we're going to spend on
no,
these different programs.
No, that's not true. That's not true. We haven't even come up with a 2013 budget. You know, so what are the issues we're facing here? We have a fiscal cliff quote unquote, which will probably solve, which isn't really a solution. Sounds a lot like what we've had in Europe. Here's our solution, which isn't really a solution. We'll be back at the table in 6 months, but at least we've absolved the crisis in the marketplace today. That's the same kind of cycle that we're entering into here in the United States. It's the fiscal cliff. Then we have to come up with, what is our budget for 2013? What exactly are we going to spend? What are we going to be pinned down to, spending this and no more? We don't even have a budget for 2013.
That's amazing to me, because every family has to budget their finances. We can't tap into Social Security. I can't. Can you?
No. We don't have the corporate, or collective, rather, slush fund that we can draw from for other purposes.
All right. So going away from the government for a second, you've got corporations right now who are realizing also that debt is extremely cheap, and they're utilizing that, you know, for advantage at this point.
Right. Now, this will be an interesting thing, because honestly, when you're looking at 2013, it's going to be impossible to have sort of the 2012 encore event. In other words, earnings in the S&P hit records in 2012. Now, profit margins actually were much better. Even though earnings were the best they've ever been, profit margins were actually much better back in the 50s and 60s. Mm. So that the earnings gains have had a lot to do with efficiency, not necessarily expansion of business, but efficiency gain from laying people off, from having one person do two people's jobs. There's been a tremendous amount of efficiency. Corporate America is run better today, arguably, than it has been in 20 or 25 years. But companies are right now buying their shares back in droves. And that's going to create an interesting dynamic for 2013, because again, as you mentioned, with interest rates set below an equilibrium level,
right,
the Fed has begun to alter the investment landscape in yet another way. Debt's cheaper than equity. Corporate executives are issuing IOUs. And with the proceeds of those bond offerings, they're turning around and buying back company shares. Consequence in 2013 for companies that are actively buying back shares is an improvement in earnings per share. Even if revenues and earnings were off next year, if you sufficiently reduce the number of shares outstanding, you're talking about the basic math here, earnings divided by the number of shares outstanding, and you have your total earnings per share. Okay. And you can actually have an increase in earnings per share, even with a decline in revenue.
Well, David, last week when we talked to Steve Forbes, you know, he talked about the pricing mechanism being all out of whack because of what the Federal Reserve is doing. You can't really determine the true value of something based on these artificially low rates.
Well, and as strange as it may seem, share buybacks by corporate America illustrates something very important. Actually, there's two things that can be illustrated here. One, how the Fed's price controls in the Treasury market distort various asset classes, including equities or stocks. And second, how companies can game public perception. Mm. In other words, you know, we're doing better than we were here in 2013.
Look at our earnings per share.
Earnings per share, right. We increased from 5 cents to 7 cents. Well, if there's less shares outstanding, you better darn well have improved your earnings per share.
Right.
Otherwise, your business is actually imploding. But if you look only at earnings without seeing various shifts in the balance sheet, you're likely missing those salient details of company financial management, or I guess you could even call it manipulation. That is the right description. The trend of manipulating the numbers in this way and in 1,000 other ways will someday be understood by mainstream investors, and it's going to cause sufficient disgust to drive them away from equities. For one reason or another, we think that this will happen, and you're going to have a generation of investors who don't want to look at stocks again.
Well, and you know, you think about survival of the fittest, and business actually does show that. You know, they make decisions based on obstacles that are in front of them, you know, from 2008, 2009, 2010, 11. We've seen these companies get leaner and meaner, but they see higher taxes coming down the board. And so what about dividends, Dave?
I love this. This is classic. You've got central planners who are saying, we need more in terms of revenues. We're going to increase taxes here and there and here and there. And here's the market dynamic. You've got special dividends. 173 companies have offered special dividends. This is up 140% from last year. And this is, again, special dividends before the dividend rate increases.
Right.
2012 is 15%.
Tax rate, yeah.
2013 is 43%.
Mm.
You know, so 150 of these have actually been in the last quarter, with a total of about $20 billion in dividends being paid out prior to the increase.
So Warren Buffett, you know, he was asking for taxes to go up, and he's like, you know, I may be rich, but by golly, I sure am willing to pay more taxes.
Well, this is a man that says taxes should go up, but guess what? He's receiving $17 million in terms of a dividend payment from the Washington Post, and I'm sure he'll be donating that to charity.
Here in 2012?
Oh, yeah, of course. No, because Washington Post announced a special dividend as well, and he's a major shareholder, and his portion of that dividend is $17 million.
So he'll pay his taxes before they go up, which he said he wanted to pay after they went up.
So Warren Buffett, he does talk a great deal about reforming the income tax in the face of his vast fortune, which I find ironic because he earned his money not in the form of income, but through capital gains. It's a much more tax-efficient way to grow wealth. One, by the way, that's not objectionable. What is objectionable is the hypocrisy of the Oracle of Omaha. Maybe it's not an objection, it's just annoying.
Well, you know, the thing is, there is a moral to the story. Businesses will adapt. They will change. You've got these central planners who are like, you know, let's just go ahead and raise taxes up to beyond 40%. Well, companies, they're going to maneuver around that or change or leave. You know, there are countries that people are just leaving because the tax rate's too high.
Precisely. You push too hard and you're going to get far less than you hope for. People operate on the basis of incentives. And if you reach beyond a reasonable level, people will change their lives and, in essence, adapt in order to accommodate the changes so that they're not impacted as greatly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, think of the British. They raised a few years ago their top marginal rate to 50%. This was, again, a few years ago. Now they're lowering it again in the wake of two-thirds of British millionaires pulling up stakes and relocating outside of Britain.
It's funny. You hear an awful lot of British accents from the rich, but they're not in Britain right now.
Well, the companies are issuing special dividends, which is essentially accelerating 2013 cash flows into 2012. The result will be higher dividend rates next year on less dividends and less total revenues. Good job. Central planners are always geniuses when it comes to figuring out how to increase revenues. This is, again, why if you don't understand market dynamics, you're always going to be at odds as a central planner with real results.
Well, and you have to look at who these central planners are, Dave, and, you know, what their background is. Not all of them are just squeaky clean. You know, I'm thinking Italy right now. You know,
the saga continues. I mean, is everything cleaned up there? No, hardly anything. They've made some progress. Yes, they've made some progress. They're further along through the crisis cycle than we are.
Right.
And frankly, 2013 is just the American entrance into our cycle of crisis. 2008, if you really want an appraisal, 2008 was just a warm-up for what we have in the United States circa 2013 to 2016. But I digress. Berlusconi, remember the name? He resigned in disgrace in 2011.
Right.
I mean, but he's had a Martha Stewart makeover in literally a matter of months. Does anyone remember that the homemaker was buried in insider trading of stocks?
So, okay, yeah. I remember the Martha Stewart thing, and now she's got more magazines than she had before. How about Berlusconi?
Can you remember what he did to lose the confidence of the Italian people? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The Italians can't remember either. I mean, this is so bread and circuses. Entertain us. We'll forgive you. The mob has offered its peace to Berlusconi. Actually, I think what he knows, because he's putting in a new bid to be premier again in Italy, actually he knows he can manipulate the media sufficiently to block any competition.
So forget about the maid in New York.
No. That was the other Italian.
Oh, this is
that was the other Italian. No, the maid in New York, Berlusconi's maid, we haven't talked about that yet. Maybe that's 2013 tabloid. No, but the reality is, again, he will manipulate the media and will block any competition and win on the basis of airtime campaigning. Should he win? You'll know there is yet another country where democracy has entered the sixth circle of hell when he wins or if he wins. Again, you remember the sixth circle of hell from Dante.
What's funny is you're quoting another Italian. We're on the Italians at this point.
Of course.
Is Dante. Yeah.
Well, a countryside of pain and anguish with the tombs of heretics. Now, who were some of the heretics that were in the sixth circle of hell?
Right.
You had the Epicureans, who denied the afterlife and lived for temporal pleasures. I mean, hello, this is Italy all over again. You know, I'm sorry, for those of you Italian-Americans, my wife is Italian, so we'll take this in stride and hopefully not be insulted.
Don't you wonder, though, what Dante's commentary on the current situation would be?
Well, honestly, this is Berlusconi's Italy. The only thing that we can't figure out is how Berlusconi escaped the eighth circle of hell. Remember, that was for fraudsters and crooks.
Mm.
This is really the nature of democracy anymore, is a question of what pleasures you offer the people.
Yeah, David, we've talked about this before. Democracy really over time, the more and more it starts to realize it can vote in gifts and favors and free things for itself. That's the way it goes. You know, we have Mario Monti, who's been there. You know, people who are actually watching good economics. They're looking at Mario Monti. This is a guy who reads Hayek and is actually trying to do something long-term favorable, not short-term free.
Monti's probably the best thing that's happened to Italy in a long, long time. But what we have Italy prior to Monti and what they're going back to in all likelihood is really what we have in the United States. Again, it's a democratically elected leadership that is in vogue. And this really does fit well in sort of somewhere between the sixth and eighth circle of hell. It's easy solutions and it's pleasure for all at no cost.
In the long run, there is.
Of course, the iron tombs of the heretics await. I mean, that's what you have in the sixth circle.
Right.
But democratically, these people just say, hey, they say anything people want to hear. And if you hear what you want to hear, you can obviously forget their past and bring them back in. That, I think, is ironic. Ironic because that's the nature of democracy, and it's one of the things that we illustrate in this year's DVD. The last one, we'll have it out in January. This is our third DVD in the series, The Fuse is Lit, and it's titled An American Reckoning. And we start with a quote by Alexander Tyler, a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It only exists until the voters discover that they can vote for themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates, promising the most benefits to public treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over lousy fiscal policy. It goes on from there. This is where we're at. Monti brought in something very unique into Italy, even if for the short term. Berlusconi wins, and I would bet that the Italian economy sinks as fast as that of the Spanish, maybe not quite as fast as the Greek. But Berlusconi brings corruption to every level of Italian politics. I never thought I'd say this, but the benefits of a bureaucrat, that is, again, going back to Mario Monti, are there because his ambitions were never political. Mm. He wasn't elected. He was chosen, and he's chosen not to stay the full term. His ego is tame by comparison.
He was a hesitant leader. You know, they had thrust him into the position, and he did a good job.
But real work has been done on his watch. With Berlusconi, you're bringing the fox right back into the henhouse. The fiscal mess, which is Italy, was not caused by Berlusconi, but it was certainly made worse by him. And that's hardly the kind of partner that the EU needs at this moment in time, trying to fix the EMU, deal with fiscal issues, deal with political differences between member states. You don't need someone with a large ego who is prone to corruption as a leader in Italy.
Well, and David, for the person who's listening right now who is saying, all right, they've talked an awful long time about Italy. I'm here in America, or I'm in Asia. How does Italy really affect me? I think what you're saying here is this is the trend worldwide.
This is where we're at on a global basis, not only in Italy, not only with the EU, not only with the ECB, now talking about the monetary mandarins, if you will, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of China, the Federal Reserve. What you find is that deflation is not acceptable in a democracy.
Therefore, print money.
Well, it makes employment more volatile if you do accept deflation,
yeah.
And thus politics becomes inherently unstable. So it's not a policy choice that's preferable in a democracy, and it puts negative pressure on consumption. So deflation will be fought tooth and tongue, and it's being fought tooth and tongue around the world by not only the politicians, but also the support they're getting from the central bankers. Inflation, on the other hand, is the acceptable course in a democratic system because, number one, people don't understand it. That
sure.
goes back to John Maynard Keynes. It's a policy that allows for political cover and ultimately scapegoating. You know, listen, if we end up fomenting a true inflation, you know who the first people are going to be that are blamed? Big oil.
Yeah.
Oil prices now at 150. These guys are making a fortune. They're the cause of the inflation. Don't you see it? It's big oil. There is that scapegoating tendency. But again, it's because inflation as a monetary tool, as a political tool, is something that offers cover for the politician and their bad fiscal policies.
Well, David, we've been trained, especially since 1971 when we went off the gold standard. We've all been trained in our generation that prices just have to go up every year. Things get more and more expensive. No one, speaking of not understanding it, no one really asks the question as to why.
Well, it is a choice. The other part of inflation is that it's a choice that sets immediate benefits in front of us. And, of course, there's long-term consequences. But that is a politician's dream, where you can have some sort of an up, some sort of a benefit today, with the consequences being after you're out of office. Mm. Again, that's why inflation is a brilliant tool for the policymaker to adopt. Fascinating. You go back to conversations that Janet Yellen had with Alan Greenspan when Alan Greenspan was in office. And Greenspan said, no, I don't think 2% is an acceptable target for inflation. We're supposed to have stable pricing. That is our mandate.
Right.
2% would be accepting inflation as our mandate. And it's not, because stable pricing is our mandate. And yet, of course, he lived with those inconsistencies and put policies in place which were highly inflationary. But you have today a form of an increase in taxation without changing the code, and it's happening universally. This is an Italian problem. This is a French problem. Yeah. This is a Greek problem. This is an American problem. Right. Why do we talk about Italy? Coming to a theater near you. That's right. Why. Because what we have is the same kind of monetary and fiscal mess. The Keynesian model has harnessed the politician's temptation to stabilize employment and control or try to influence consumption. And they're pushing that model as far as they possibly can.
Well, Dave, we seem to have the perfect storm coming together. We have unemployment. It's high. We have the costs of things going higher and higher and higher. We've got an equities market and all the investment markets right now. If they are yielding anything, it's from false premise. And it's coming from low, artificially low interest rates in other areas. So, you know, in reality, the person on the street, let's say the waitress in the restaurant, okay, who's not just working one job, she's working three. The person who's right now living on credit cards. We talked to a young lady last night who said, I started to realize, she's got several jobs, but she was starting to live on her credit card, and she realized, wait, I've seen that kind of destruction in my family. I have to do something different.
The number of Americans who were sobered for the first time in 2008 by a change, an unfortunate change, an unexpected change, look ahead and have some caution still inside of them. 2008 was, I think, for many Americans, preparation for what lies ahead. Mm. The challenges of unemployment, the need to work extra hours to make up for a spouse's lost wages, that has instilled a basic insecurity into people. Getting caught up in the bills here in the last couple of years has been good, making sure that the kids are taken care of, knowing that things are not as easy as they used to be. Again, these are the realities that the average American is living with.
Right.
There's a sense of foreboding, and it goes beyond the fiscal cliff. It goes beyond who is leading the country. Clearly, it goes beyond who's leading the country in Italy. There is a sense that harder times are coming.
Right.
And again, you see people realizing that they can't do what they were doing. As you mentioned, someone realizes that credit card balances are rising, and this is simply to cover the basics. This is not extravagant spending. You know, you watch family members go through difficult circumstances and struggle for years to pay off debt, and you know that you have a problem. You
right.
recognize the problem, and you start working more hours. Work two jobs. The question is, as the man and woman in the street deal with these realities, how long does it take for their experience to translate into a different body politic? In other words, you look at your finances and realize you can't just put more on the credit card. You're going to have to work more hours. You're going to have to get a second job to make sure that you don't get into the debt trap. You know that the debt trap is a dangerous one. It's a quick process to be ensnared in, and it's a very painful process and a long period of time to get out of.
Oh, I'm sure many listeners are sitting there going, yep, I did that the hard way, and we've done it the hard way a number of times.
And so as individuals, we're willing to do the hard work to fix the problem.
Right.
The fiscal cliff is just one illustration of a lack of restraint where our government has done the same thing. We're back on credit cards again, and it's easier to spend doing that. Again, future credit. We'll pay this off tomorrow. We'll pay this off tomorrow. We'll pay this off tomorrow. And yet we need to hold them accountable. The only way we can do that is by changing the expectations that they understand. What is it that they're supposed to be doing? How is it that they represent us? Is it just to bring more money back to the state from the tax revenue coffer? Or do they have a different mode of operation moving forward? They don't today. It's going to take us at least one election cycle, maybe two or three, to communicate from the hoi polloi, you and me and the rest of us, that we have a different set of expectations. It's actually a very simple set of expectations. It's that you manage your finances like we have to manage ours, as if there are consequences to our actions.
David, don't you think going into debt and continuing that cycle is just a form of denial? I think about cleaning my garage, okay? I hate cleaning my garage, and it always, for whatever reason, it doesn't stay clean. But when I can't get the car, well, when my wife can't get her car in the garage. That's when the garage gets cleaned. And so there has to be a breaking point here at some point where the fiscal cliff, whether it's a fiscal cliff or whether it's just an outright denial of our creditors buying our debt anymore, there's got to be, like you said, this cusp event that forces discipline.
The first change will be culture changing, and it will be the common man changing. And ultimately, you know, that question of does art reflect culture or culture reflect art? Mm-hmm. Our government reflects the people. And we have for decades spent too much money. And our government reflects individuals having done the very same thing. Now, individuals are learning a different way. It is going to be some period of lag time, 5, 10, 15 years, before government is clued in that we want and expect something very differently. That's what we have to fight for. That's what we have to hold as an expectation. They operate by the same set of rules.
Well, I think it's important to talk, like we did a few weeks ago, Dave, that this is not a hopeless end to the world, okay? What we're talking about is it is an end to the credit living that we've been on, this debt living, but it also sets the next generation up for something that could be very, very profitable and very, very prosperous.
When you look at the nature of a credit cycle, it is a boom-to-bust cycle, and there's nothing wrong with a bust. It cleans the decks, if you will. It clears out the system for all the inefficient businesses that have been run on the basis of government subsidies. Do you know what you do? You allow them to fail, and you have new businesses with great entrepreneurs who are willing to take reasonable risks and work their tails off to succeed. The decks are cleared, the field is open, and you can bring your ideas to the marketplace.
Well, and for those who saved, look at John Templeton, the advice that he had, you know, save 50% or 51% of your income if you can do that.
That's right.
And then buy for pennies on the dollar when this occurs.
Well, that's right. So what we see is not bad news. We just see a part of the human cycle of, and yes, it does include tragedy, to the degree to which you allow it to include you. What is that degree? We've begun a discovery process. 2008 was probably the most eye-opening as we looked into the gates of hell for the first time. And you go through that Divine Comedy, Dante's book, The Divine Comedy, and you didn't begin with paradise. You began with hell. You went through purgatory, you went through hell, and then you discovered paradise. And your appreciation of paradise was in part because you understood the contrast. You understood that the present pleasures that were promised and the people who suffered in the context of that sixth circle of hell, it wasn't so meaningful in light of eternity. Again, this is not an eternal message as much as it is to say we do have something on the other side. Crisis does not define our generation, but it may define the success of this generation on the other side of crisis. And that is particularly interesting to us as we see the right kinds of leaders born through this particular period of time and offering a very different America, one that we're excited to participate in.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.